you put that into perspective, it's like when Michael Jordan used to go and just to go into the zone and just continually hit threes, and he would not miss. That is what that's what the operators go into. You go into the flow. You go into the zone where nothing. You're not thinking of fear. You're not thinking of dying. You're not thinking of anything. But this is my job. I'm going out there. I'm going to win this. And I trust these guys next to me, and let's just get robotic. And it just turns into a robotic movement. But your world opens up, and colors just pop vivid.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Welcome into the Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway along with Cameron Mills. And man, we've got a great guest today. The movie 13 Hours, if you've ever seen that movie, it's basically the true story of what happened in Benghazi, where we had some heroes that stepped up and kind of defied orders to protect or try to protect our ambassador, and all hell broke loose. And it's in those moments when all hell breaks loose, Cameron, that you find out what your real character is. And these guys, they had backbone and they had character.
They had backbone to do what they were, to be there in the first place.
That's what I love.
Yeah, I love the people who enlist in our military, the people who, you know, enlist in these dangerous, you know, frontline jobs. They are amazing to me, because I think about the stupid thing that I did in college, you know, and after college, which was important to me. But then I look at people like this and I'm in awe. I'm in awe of guys like Chris. So.
Chris Tonto Peronto, and he was one of those guys that was there at the time. He's a former Army Ranger, right? Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, former Army Ranger. You
awesome.
Got that right.
Welcome to the show, man. We really, really are honored to have you here. It's fantastic to talk to you.
No, thanks again. Now, you guys, come on. I ain't nothing special at all. I just appreciate you guys give me some time to talk a little bit. It's an honor for me.
Well, you were there, and everybody hears the kind of flashpoint politically about Benghazi, but it's a story that needs to be told. So, for those uninitiated, walk us through what happened and what your part in it was.
Well, we were, and we as a team, I say we, my teammates, which consisted of all the branches of the service. We had three Marines, or four, and I know Marines don't like to be called former Marines, but they're always Marines. But being a Ranger, I'm going to say whatever I want, because then the Marines are going to have to take it, because I got the microphone right now. We had three former Marines, and then we had two Navy SEALs, former Navy SEALs, and then I was a guy from the 75th Ranger Regiment, 2nd Battalion, and we all actually had been out of the service, and we were contractors at the time. We're called private security contractors or private military contractors. And to all you naysayers out there, no, we weren't mercenaries. We worked for the U.S. government.
That's the word that was coming to my mind. Yeah. Mercenary.
Well,
mercenary.
I'm glad you immediately corrected it. Well, and just so people, mercenary is somebody who works for money for a foreign government. We actually were hired directly, and we worked directly for the CIA. I had a contract directly with the CIA, nobody else in it. And so all of us did that, and all of us basically were veterans and still serving. Some of us did it because some of the guys did it because of money. They did.
Sure.
I did it myself, and my other buddy Boone, that was a Marine. We actually were injured and medically discharged from the Army, and the military. He was a Marine, I was an Army. And we, you know, what do we do? So, you know, we talk about filling voids. It was something that just came up out of nowhere. You know, how that path, you just kind of follow that path and you don't know where it's going to lead you. Well, that's what happened. I was medically discharged for having Crohn's disease after spending 8 years in the military and going, what do I do now? I didn't have a plan, because my plan was to retire from the military. And then all of a sudden contracting just came out of nowhere. And, you know, a company called Blackwater called me and said, hey, do you want to go to Iraq? And I said, okay, as what? They said, as a contractor. I said, you mean go build houses and stuff?
That's what
they're like, what? They're like, no. As a military, you're going to provide security for the State Department. And that was initially with the State Department. Then I went to the CIA. But that's how it worked. And then 10 years later, I did that for 10 years. People don't realize that from the story on Benghazi, they think, well, Libya, that was all you did. No, I actually was deploying for 10 years before Libya even happened. So I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, I've been to Yemen, I did anti-piracy work off the coast of Somalia. I did a lot of fun stuff. I worked all the Middle East and even South America and Central America. So when Libya happened, we were there as security contractors, the team. And long story short, you know, at 13 hours, if you can go see the movie or read the book, if you want to know what happened, the movie is actually quite accurate. We responded to an attack on the U.S. It was called the Temporary Mission Facility by the State Department. We weren't State Department. We responded to their attack because we were the only guys in Libya that could. And we were told, you know, the political aspect of it, you want to get political about it. It's not. This is what happened. We were told to stand down and wait. So wait once. It was a wait, stand down, then another wait. And after 30 minutes of us watching the attack, because we were only about 3/4 of a mile away, we disobeyed orders from our CIA leadership. And you know, expletives involved because I'm a Ranger. I won't say it on the show, but we said, we're going. And we went over there and we tried to assist. And it ended up turning into something that could have lasted 30 minutes if we would have had the military support that I was asking for. It turned into 13 hours because we had to fight our way onto the objective, which was the State Department facility on foot. And if you don't understand combat on foot, when you're trying to move, shoot and move, and trying to sneak, and you're not unmanned, you just don't have the forces to represent to equalize the force that you're going against. You have to take your time. It took us 30 minutes just to go 400 meters on foot just to get on there. So by the time we actually got on the compound to help fight the people off to save Ambassador Chris Stevens, who was the one that was under attack and they were trying to get. And his personnel, it was an hour, and then we ended up fighting him off. And Cameron, you play sports. I'll give you the size of this compound that we were trying to fight these guys off. Ansar Sharia and Al Qaeda in the Maghreb was 3 football field size. There's 6 of us trying to fight off on this. That's 9 acres approximately for people that go by acreage. But that's 3 foot. Think of 3 football fields and think of 6 guys.
Yeah.
All these buildings spread out. There's fire everywhere. But to be honest with you, it's quite beautiful. It's quite astonishing. Combat is when you allow yourself to go into what we call the flow. You allow yourself to open up. You fight that adrenaline to not turning into a flight anymore. It's into a fight response, and you push that adrenaline outside. Yeah, I do my studying. I know you took the big shot. Think of that shot that you took and that world just opening up. You know that world.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, it wasn't against Kansas, so we're good. It's okay.
But it could have easily been against Kansas, but it wasn't. You're right.
But it was against Duke, so we're good. We're good on that.
All right, Chris, I got to interrupt you real quick because I want to ask you this because you're making a lot of associations with sports, and so I'm gonna turn this back on you and ask you about one that I'm thinking of and it sounds like it's what you're saying. There comes a moment in sports, and I've got to be so careful here because it's not the same thing, but I understand what you're saying because you're putting your life on the line. But there comes a moment before the game when you're nervous, the nerves are hitting, and you're thinking about what could go wrong. I imagine you guys are going through that moment as well, but it sounds like what you're saying when you make that turn is, all right, now we've made our decision. We're in this game. We're in this fight. We're gonna do everything we can to protect this mission, as you call it. So no nerves flowing at that point. I mean, at that point, you're just reacting.
It turns into it's time to go get the work done. And I played for college. I played college football. I had a football scholarship. I was actually a little fast, little slot back, good punt returner, and so that little bit right there. Put into the military, it is. It's exactly this. I'll be honest. It's exactly the same. It's just you notch it up about 10 because if you lose in this game, you die.
Thank you for making that distinction.
but it is similar, and that's where I could pull that from. You know, I grew up around sports. And that's where it was. That adrenaline. Think of it. You're training. You're practicing. Here's a Super Bowl. Let's go do it.
Yeah.
That is what it is. But then it turns into, of course. Let's not lose, guys, because we lose. But you don't think of that. You don't think of we're not going to lose. You just think of it's time. We've done enough training. It turns into habitual movements. It turns into I'm with this outstanding team of guys. You know, I'm with professionals. We're special operations community. We've been doing this forever. We're in our 40s. We're salty. We're the if you want to put it in perspective, guys, listen up. We're the Tom Brady's now. We're absolutely. Let's go get this job done. And it is, you just go into the flow. You know, I'm glad I don't mind doing the sports comparisons because I played it for so long, and I grew up around the NCAA. My dad was a national championship football coach at Brigham Young. He coached the linebackers. So I grew up around Steve Young. I grew up around Jim McMahon, which is a blessing. Coach Lavelle Edwards, guy, oh my gosh, how could I not learn leadership growing up in my younger years by being around guys like that? But yeah, you put that into perspective. It's like, you know, when Michael Jordan used to go and just to go into this zone and just continually hit threes, and he would not miss. That is what that's what the operators go into. You go into the flow. You go into the zone where nothing. You're not thinking of fear. You're not thinking of dying. You're not thinking of anything. But this is my job. I'm going out there. I'm going to win this. And I trust these guys next to me, and let's just get robotic. And it just turns into a robotic movement. But your world opens up, and colors just pop vivid. And just it's like a sixth sense that you get. And that's why when we come back home, though, it's hard to reacclimate. And yeah, because you can't get that anywhere else. And Cameron, I'm not downplaying sports at all. Because
you need to compare to this, Chris.
All I want to say is I don't care if I made it to the NFL, if I played professional, you can't get that feeling anywhere else.
Yeah,
because it's life or death. It is literally, and I'm not making a pun, it's life or death. and basically for the next, we fought on that objective till midnight. We found some survivors. We did find two. We found one dead body, which that's always, and that's where the really big difference comes in, because you can lose a player to injury.
Right.
Oh my gosh, we just found somebody that's dead, and we have to fight through this because we don't know this is going to end. You can't quit. There's no quitting. We found him. We found Sean Smith. And then we ended up, actually, after we found Sean Smith, we got hit again by RPGs and small arms fire, and we had to fight them off and then get back to our annex. And all this time, too, the U.S. government, people, they can say, well, nobody knew. No, they were actually watching it all on an ISR, a drone feed,
right,
from 11:45 on. They knew what was going on, and they just watched.
Wasn't there a unit not too far away by air that was told,
they
started to come and then told not to?
There were several, brother. There was the command, the ones portrayed in the movie. We couldn't portray all of them, but the ones that were shown in the movie that are accurate, 10th Special Forces Group, which is called the Commander's Extremist Force, that is actually what they're for. They're in Croatia, and they got moved to Sigonella, to pre-position, and that's just a hop, skip, and a jump right across the Mediterranean to Libya. They would actually got moved over to 10th Special Forces Group. Their job is to come in and assist in situations exactly like that's what they're there for. Plus, we had 555th Fighter Wing, which is in Aviano Air Base in Italy, which is maybe 45 minutes afterburners to Libya. But then they also have a detachment at Souda Bay, Greece, which is 10 minutes. Yeah, the Fast Company of Marines at Sigonella, and also one in the EMU in the Mediterranean, which is a Marine Expeditionary Unit, which is another high-speed infantry unit. The Fast Company of Marines, that's what they're there for, is if embassies or U.S. facilities overseas are seized, they're there to get over and get and help out.
So why didn't they? Why did they tell them not to go?
You know, it comes down to political reasons. We had Al-Qaeda was on the run. We were doing things there that we shouldn't have been doing too. ISIS, we made ISIS. I'll put it right now. We made it. We made ISIS by assisting the overthrow of Assad in Syria. And there was a lot of weapons in Libya that Gaddafi had, a lot of arms that, because of my dang non-disclosure, I can't talk about it, but that's about, I think by me just saying that, I think people can deduce what we're doing there. And that was something the American people didn't know. And it was both political parties that were involved with it. So it's when I saw politics really take over, and I saw that lives didn't matter. Politics mattered more than lives. And that was disappointing to me because I'd served for 18 years.
Yeah.
I felt like being a patriot, and I'm like, holy crap, well, these politicians don't give two craps about us. But Chris, you don't quit. You keep fighting.
Chris, let me ask you this. I know how I feel as American about what happened with that. I don't want to speak for Leland, but you were let's go back to the sports analogies. You were a player in the game, and you said, you play not to lose. Well, let me ask you this then. In this situation, and look at it from a 10,000-foot view, did we lose? Did we win? Did we tie?
We lost. Because we turned Libya into a failed state, which is now basically a training ground for ISIS. We've turned Syria into another hot, another basically a hive or incubator for terrorist organizations. We went in there. Egypt's even I don't even know how stabilized Egypt's even right now as well. We destabilized the region, and politicians, they don't care. They don't, and that's something that the media doesn't want to talk about because of who was in charge at the time. And I'll be honest, I could have cared less if it was Donald Trump or George Bush or Obama or Hillary in charge. Whoever wasn't, they failed. And so it was the Obama administration that was in charge and failed. Well, they failed. But that's it. That's the facts. Just like when a football, that we can get now, just like when a coach loses or a team loses, yeah, it's the coach's fault. If the coach is the head, he's in charge. Yeah. It doesn't matter who it is. You know, Tom Osborne, fantastic coach. He lost some games here. He got blamed for some failures here, but he also took responsibility for it. That's the difference between politicians is they don't, right, and they turn it. And then the media, whoever they want to side, they're going to try to just, oh, well, nothing to see here. Right. It's okay.
How does that make
you? No, we failed.
How does that make you feel to have been on? I mean, you, I've had some. I get emails from people all the time that in the political arena that are like, because I reference Benghazi a lot because I think it's a huge failure. It's everything you just said, and I'm passionate about it. I saw 13 hours. I've had you on my radio show from time to time as well, and I'm passionate about it because we did something America was never supposed to do. We left people behind.
Yeah.
And you know, you guys were completely on your own. You said something a while ago that really stuck with me. You had to fight to defy orders. Yeah. You not only defied orders to go to the compound to try to save the ambassador, you had to risk your life and fight to get there. So how does that make you feel when you see the media and politicians literally get away without ever having to take accountability for what they do?
Bro, you can say that they get away with murder, literally. I'll say it. I'll say it in our case. They get away with murder, and the media is complicit to it. It disgusts me. It makes me very bitter. It makes me jaded. I do stay positive as far as best I can, saying, hey, there's still hope, because I do see good things with the American people, because I still am a public speaker. I speak everywhere. Gosh dang, I need to slow down a little bit. I do a lot of, me and Boone have our own tactical training company, and we've brought a lot of people in that were new to firearms and tactics. We brought them in, show them, hey, this isn't a bad thing. You guys, this is actually give you confidence. I'm seeing smiles on people's faces, so I see hope out there in just the American populace. But as far as politicians, as far as things that went on in Libya, and how the media acts, I see it as a propaganda machine. I see the politicians and media here the same as I saw in those third world countries where politicians stay in power forever, and the media spins to make you believe what they want you to believe, or whatever the flavor of the month is that month. It really disturbs me, and it angers me. But it also motivates me too, because that's why I keep speaking. I want to go home and go fish every day with my son. But it feels like I'm not putting myself on a pedestal, but there's not a calling here that this is what I still need to be doing at this time.
You brought up the word mission earlier, talking about the complex. You've got a mission. There's something that's deep in your heart. You said, you know what, I've been given this experience for a reason. If I don't talk about it, then that's a large failure. And I completely understand that, Chris. Let me ask you this. I want to go back to, let's get away from the mission, get away from Benghazi. I want to go back to your childhood. I mean, what made you? I mean, what you talked about your dad earlier, I think off the air, and you mentioned him on the air. But tell us about your, like, childhood and your growing up.
My, I don't give enough credit to my mom. My mom was harder than nails, too. She was my first grade teacher. I got in trouble all the time. That woman, she wouldn't worry too much about disciplining me with a yardstick if I needed it. And I did need it a lot. So they loved me to death, and they taught me. They did. They taught me what right or wrong is. Not always. I can't always. I wish I could always do the right thing, but I'm fallible. I'm human. That's just how it is. But I try, because my parents raised me that way, and they taught me to never quit, and they taught me to always pick myself up if I fell down, and they taught me that if there's something that is honorable, no matter if you're standing alone, that you stand up for it, even if you may be the only person doing it, and that's what brought me up. And then just, you know, growing up in the country, I grew up in a little town in Alamosa, Colorado, playing outside, you know, riding my bike without a helmet on, you know, riding a motorcycle without a helmet on, walking my dog a mile to the river so I could go shoot the catfish when they used to come up, or the carp, when they used to come up on the river. You know, that, how, who, you can't do that anymore when you're seven.
No. Seven?
Now that's what I'm saying. I was like, hey, can I take, hey, mom, can I walk down to the Rio Grande and take the dog and go shoot? Yeah, go ahead. Just be back by dinner. You can't do that anymore. But it gave you that toughness and it gave you that confidence. And then also just failing. Always, I remember when me and my buddy thought it was a bright idea when we were eight to light cattails on fire out in the country, and we burned about 15 acres of land because we were stupid.
Cattails being the firecracker, right?
The fire, yeah,
yeah, not actual cattails. Not actual cattails.
All my ASPCA, they're going to be on the other. No, they play cattails, you know, but then getting disciplined for it as well. But then, you know, growing up, and I wasn't always the greatest athlete. I wasn't always the best student. I wasn't, but it was my dad saying, well, if you want something, you got to work for it. And getting up in high school when I was running track to so I could be the best 400 meter runner on the track team and play baseball at the same time, and doing my extra workouts and riding my bike to school at 5 a.m. to run around the track, then go shower, then go to school, then go to practice. That's what was instilled in me growing up, that you have to work hard if you want to accomplish a goal. And if you want to be, I don't want to say a winner, you know, winners, that I don't like that term. I said just be successful and be the best person you can be. You have to do all that extra work on your own. And that's all of us on that team had done that up to that point in our careers. Of course, we wouldn't have made it to the levels we did without it. I mean, you have to put in that extra work. But having those guys, and then when that night happened, it was, let's just keep going. All right, nobody's coming. So what? That's an obstacle. Let's get over it. All right. Yeah. Hey, guess what? They're hitting us again. That's an obstacle. Let's kick the crap out of them so they don't want to hit us anymore. Here they come again. It's just continually overcoming obstacles, but that's how I grew up. It was never a participation trophy. It was never here. You either did your best and you accomplished the goal, or you didn't, and then you work hard to do it better next time. That's what it was.
You mentioned, I know we're kind of jumping around here, but I think that the flow of this conversation is important because we're kind of hitting these highlights of things. And you, when you speak, Chris, you say so much important information and accountability. Okay, we talked about politicians not having to take accountability. In life, in real life, not political life or movie life or whatever, but in real life, I mean, talk about the idea of extreme accountability and how important that is to success in any endeavor, whether or not it's on the battlefield, on the basketball court, or just in life in general, business or whatever.
Well, I can even say myself recently, I'm not as good a shooter as I used to be out there because I haven't been practicing. It's nobody else's fault but my own. I have to take accountability for my skill level declining because I'm not taking the extra time to go in there to the range and shoot. And I have to be up at a certain level because I'm an instructor now. I'm a fire instructor. I'm a celebrity fire, if you want. I mean, it's ridiculous, but you are. Now, holy crap, the guy from Benghazi, he can't shoot. Why is he trying? But then you get the internet people on there and they're hammering you on the, even the gun forum guy. I mean, but whose fault is that? It's nobody else's fault but mine. So what do? I go to the range now extra. I do put more time in. I do what I used. So it's just things like that. If you're not accomplishing what you have set out to accomplish, or your skill levels are declining because skills are perishable, and you're not putting the extra work in, and then you're making an excuse for it because I'm old, my eyes are getting bad. Yes, I am old. Yes, my eyes are getting bad. They're not as good as they used to be, but so now I've got to train a little harder. If you're not willing to say that and look at yourself first before pointing blame at everybody else, because that's what the politicians, God, I can't stand those people. They point blames at everybody else. They're looking inward and saying, hey, you know what? What do I need to do to improve? What am I not doing so I'm actually starting to get worse at whatever skills I need to maintain? Or it's just always self-reflection, and we don't see that. You don't see that within kids nowadays either. No self-reflection at all. It's because it's too hard to say, oh, you know what? I failed here, but let me try harder. It's easier to say, no, it's somebody else's fault. And I wasn't raised like that.
Well, you know, speaking that you weren't raised like that, one of the things I already love about you is you said this, I think, again, off the air as we were kind of talking before we hit play or record. You said, you know what, guys, I've got a certain amount of time here because I want to get your basketball camp. I think you said with your son and your daughter,
yeah,
and you want to go watch them
yeah.
play. So you talked about your dad and your mom and what they instilled in you. You know, and I'm sure you're trying to instill the exact same things in your children, but how are you doing that? I mean, you know, the time, okay, sure, it's more time and time matters, but like specifically, sure. Like, what's important to you that your kids learn from you?
The discipline, you know what, the easiest thing, and I tell people this, the easiest thing when I talk and say, hey, this is all you got to do to tell your kids, remind them to say sir and ma'am.
Yeah.
Remind them to have manners. Open the door for somebody else. That right there is putting others before yourself. Just those little things there that you do not, you don't see that anywhere anymore. Holy crap! You don't see kids anymore. Yes sir, no sir. When I do, it's almost like, oh my gosh, this little boy had actually called me sir. This never happens anymore. Where it used to happen all the time. If you didn't say it, you get here, five across the eyes, son. Yep. You better say sir next time. But I think discipline is extremely important. I do discipline my kids, and I do make sure they say sir or ma'am. I do. Hey, when you're talking to the waitress here, make sure you look her in the eyes or him in the eyes, and make sure you're having some confidence in yourself and tell them what you want. If you make a mistake, we'll tell them again. There's no problem here. Hey, see that lady? She's going in the door. Go open. Chivalry's not dead in this family. Even if she says no, thank you, at least make the opportunity to, because that's how I was raised. It's not. You're not being misogynistic. You're being a gentleman, and that's where I start with the kids. And then it's just from here on out when I watch them play. And I got used to get hard on my son a lot when he would put his head down after a strikeout. So I'm like, get your head up, yeah. And keep working hard at it. You got to keep practicing on it. And my daughter too. My daughter didn't want to practice today. You want to go to the camp. So what do? We get your butt out of bed. You sign up for this. You get out there on the floor and literally drug her out of the house. Yeah, and we're not forcing her to do basketball. It's not that, but she signed up.
She
made
committed.
A commitment.
Yeah.
Exactly. If we didn't say, you've got to take camp, that's different.
Right.
You don't tell, hey, you're taking camp this week. No.
It's the thing of once you start it, you're going to finish it.
Yeah. You're going to finish it. Exactly.
That's
the biggest thing right there.
Don't you think, well, just along this theme of discipline and extreme accountability, don't you think that if we can teach that, the people who take extreme accountability, that take that tack in life, won't they be extremely successful as a result? Because what you talk about here is true, that in society there's not a lot of accountability anymore. So the people that do take it seems like we could stand out a lot easier. You know, I used to tell my dad, I'd be like, but nobody else. He says, well, then you ought to be able to stand out.
And that is completely 100% spot on. I'll give you a specific example. I was kicked out of the military first time I was in. I did some stupid stuff. I went to Ranger Battalion, and then I did something stupid. Actually, I put it in my book, The Ranger Way. I wrote about it, so it's not like I'm hiding it out there. If you want to read about it, they can. I had to take 2 years off from the military. Now, I was blessed to have a fantastic battalion commander in General Stanley McChrystal at the time, and a great company commander in Colonel LaCamera, I believe now is General LaCamera. And First Sergeant by the name of Frank Grippy, that they were able at least to still get me an honorable discharge. But during that 2 year time frame, I failed. I failed. I got booted out of the Army. So what did I do? I didn't go home and cry. I took a GRE. I went and got my master's degree. And then I reenlisted back in the military. I didn't quit. I hadn't finished what I started. And I did it all over again. So in society, when I went back in again, the standards is actually lowered to what they were before. I remember the PT standards were ungodly when I first went in, just to max a PT test. Now they were ridiculously, the standards had lowered. So I would look like dang Superman out here where I went in the first time. I was good. I was very, very well in shape, but I wasn't just crushing all the standards that had been set because we had lowered the standards in the U.S. military. So that's what I'm getting at with this example society. Yeah, we lowered standards. So yes, I did excel. I was scoring 380 something on the extended scale on PT test. You know, a shooting expert, of course, and I should anyway. Going to Ranger Battalion, you should be at that level anyway. But it was almost like, oh my gosh, this is too easy. Are you kidding me? And so what getting at, back at that is that, you know, should you be excelling? Should people be excelling if they just put a little effort into it? Yes, and I'll give you that exact example, because the military, where it was harder than nails just to even max the PT test or max any standards, when I came back in 2 years, I was about 2.5 years later into the military, the standards had dropped so low. Thank you, General Shinseki, for doing that. That was, and that shouldn't have, that because they needed numbers, they just needed personnel. They didn't care about the quality, they needed quantity. That I went back in, I was like, my gosh, I don't even need to really, I'm going to keep working hard, but this is a joke. This is way too easy. And so, you're spot on. And again, that's a real world example for you there.
One of the things, Chris, too, that you mentioned, and Leland, to your point, how we define what success is. See, to me, success is, I mean, we ought to be dying the best version of ourselves ever. Right. I mean, that when our life is over, we should be the best version of ourselves. And that's great. But it's also, success is not, we define it in terms of dollars and cents nowadays. When to me, you know, it's someone that it's take your little kid who strikes out, you know, maybe strikes out three times in a game. He gets up for the fourth. It's that willingness to not quit to me that defines success more than anything. And I think that's what we're losing more than anything. It becomes so easy to quit and so easy to give up and so easy to get down on ourselves when, you know, it's also, son, pick your head up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just get up and try again. I'll be honest here, this last 3 or 4 years, I've done quite well as far as finances. I've probably made more money the last 3 years than I did the 3 years I was contract. You know, 3 years in comparison to contracting, but I'm not doing what I love, and I'll be honest, I feel more empty. Money doesn't make you happy.
No.
Being around people that are extremely wealthy, you're around, and I watch them. I'm not going to give their names specifically, but you know, come on, I'm around Paramount. I'm around people that make movies. I'm around these media I'm around these people. And I look at him and I'm like, gosh, they do not look happy.
Yeah.
More money you get, and I believe that, the more money you get, you want to be comfortable, you want to pay your bills, but then there comes a point where it's just excess, and now you're empty. You're an empty shell of a person. You're really not.
Well, let's move to that. Let's move to that, Chris, because that's one thing. Okay, so if you're going to admit that, you know what, you've been doing better financially than you've ever done in your life, but you find yourself being more empty. What would fulfill you? I mean, I imagine, you know, your training, the thing you've got going on with your training, I imagine that in some way fulfills you. Your kids, but what fulfills Chris Peronto?
Going back overseas and redeploying again, doing what I used to do in some aspect. That fulfilled me. When you are overseas or you're in dangerous doing operations that may be dangerous, or they are not maybe they are, and there is a matter of life or death that may happen, and you're protecting people and you're feeling like you're doing things for your country that need to be done to protect people here. I've said it a million times. I think I even wrote about it once. I am my best person when I'm overseas because focus. There is no atheist in foxholes. Put it that way. There's none. you can lose perspective. You can lose perspective over here because of all the temptations that are here when you're safe. You know, it's easy life. And this is the greatest country in the world, folks. If people won't believe that, go overseas, go live over there, go do whatever. This is where the greatest country in the world, because we can do whatever ever we want. And we don't have to worry about getting blown up to go get a cup of coffee. I mean, that's how great is that? You can brush your teeth with the water and not worry about having dysentery. This is how great this country is. But we lose focus on the man upstairs. We lose focus on God. And I tell people, if you don't believe in God, then believe in something. There is something else out there. I'm not going to tell you have to. A good Christian is not going to tell you that you have to believe in God, but at least believe in something. And when you're overseas, it is. Your faith goes up tenfold. You become a better person overseas because the brotherhood's there. You are giving of yourself. You do. Hey, believe me, you're praying. Hey, please, dear Lord, you know, if I don't make it out of here today, just please have me do my best. You're praying. You say, well, why aren't you doing back here in the States? You know, I wish I could answer that for you. I do pray. I do, but I don't feel like I'm the best person I can be unless I'm overseas. And that's just, I don't know. I really wish I had a better answer for you, but I don't, not at this point in time.
I think it's a great answer.
I do too. I love the honesty of it too.
I do.
Real quick too, because I know you've got a short amount of time. You've got to get you to your kids, but tell me about the movie process. You hung out with the moguls. You consulted on the film. I know it was very important to you guys.
Yeah, it was.
That it be accurate. So tell me what that was like, the process of making a movie that became a Hollywood blockbuster.
Well, it was actually quite another experience. It was great. It was something that I never expected to do. Didn't plan on doing it. There wasn't anything in my life, but it was something like, hey, I get to experience this. That's what life's all about, doing experiences. Experiencing things that you can talk about later, that you can sit back when you're older, like you said, when you're old and think, man, that was cool. That was, at least I got to do that. So being on the set and getting to know Pablo Schreiber, who played me in the movie, is a fantastic individual. We have great political differences, just completely, but we are still friends, and I still think highly of him because his work ethic is unbelievable, and he's just a great person. I don't care what his politics are. He's a fantastic individual. But he got my mannerisms down, so watching him on set was it really brought me back to, holy crap, this is what really happened. That's when you start to really kind of say, wait a second, this is really, everything's taking place. This is what happened that night. Now people are really going to see it. And then you're on set just watching guys like Michael Bay, who's one of the top directors. And I don't, people can say all they want about him if they want to. That man is a workaholic too. And he takes his craft seriously. That's impressive when people put that amount of effort into it. He's a professional. Unbelievable. Watch those guys on set and just be there and get to experience a movie being made. And then to see it on the big screen, seeing the final product, and seeing that he actually did keep it as accurate as he possibly could, trying to squish, 2.5 hours into a 13-hour firefight. Mm. It was unbelievable just to see him do it. But you also watch, you're like, man, I could never be in. I wouldn't want to do this. This would not something I'd want to do.
It wouldn't fulfill
for my
you.
Entire life as being an actor. No. Well, it was cool to be experiencing.
When you were watching, when you were aware that a Hollywood actor was mimicking your every move, did you change anything?
No, like, no.
I gotta put my best foot forward here now. I always wear cologne.
I showered a little more. No, we had to keep it accurate. You know what was okay? Let me. I'll give it. Here's. I got another. If you won't know this, I think I posted a picture a long time ago when I started to get on social media. Now I know how to do it. I didn't back in the day, but when Pablo and I would hang out, he's like, hey, we got to know each other. Remember, we were driving to a range because. The guy named Harry Humphreys, who's the military consultant for Michael Bay, generally his movies. He's a Navy SEAL, so he brings all the SEALs in to train the actors on their tactics and techniques, which is good. Mm-hmm. But they're not Rangers. So I'm sorry, SEALs. There's a way that Rangers do things. So I said, okay, Pablo, you got the tactics down. Now let me show you how to really do it. No, I'm kidding. I love you, but I'm saying, let me show you how Rangers do it. So we would go, but during our travel to this range, there was this big old, like McDonald's Playland area. And no, I didn't put my, I go, hey, you want to go climb up in there with me? And he's a big dude. He couldn't fit. So I was like, I'm going to climb. And I started playing in the little McDonald's player, and he's taking pictures of it. And so I said, this is me. This is how I am. And then it comes across on the screen of that. Yes, I'm egocentric. Yes, I speak my mind. Yes, I have confidence as well. Yes, sometimes I overstep it and I forget to put my frontal lobe filter in, and I say probably things I shouldn't say, but because in that area, you're going to say what's on your mind. But also, I'm going to give my life for you, and I'm going to fight like hell to make sure you go home alive. Yes, I'm going to say stuff, and I'm going to call you out. I don't care if you're CIA or not. If you're doing something stupid, I'm going to tell you that. But the bottom line is that I am always going to make sure you get home, even if it cost me my life. And that came through in the movie.
Yeah.
So when I saw Pablo doing it, I was like, man, that's spot on. Even the dance moves were pretty good. I'm a better dancer. I am. I'm a better dancer. But he did a pretty good job.
That's awesome.
The only thing is, though, he did get jacked. I mean, that dude was like a D end, and he's a big guy. He's like 6'3", 240. And I watched the movie, and I'm in good shape, but I'm not a big guy. I shrunk an inch now. I'm not going to give myself that 5'9".
There's a pause there. I'm 5". Yeah. All right, what am I going to say?
I'm 5'9". I can't say that. 5'10" anymore. But even the tattoos, I couldn't believe they got the tattoos spot on. I'm like, oh my gosh.
That's awesome.
Those look so. No, it was a fantastic experience because they got it right. And if they would have screwed it up or got anything wrong, that would have been offensive or just demeaning to me because we didn't really have any creative control. Then it would be different, but no, they did an outstanding job, and that's why the movie's going to keep going, even though it's not politically sound on the left, and it was never really pushed by the left to go see it, like I told Paramount guy, this is going to be a marathon. This is going to be a cult movie forever.
And well, it was the thing I loved about it was it was not specifically political. I mean, it was clear what the implications were, but I didn't feel like that they were trying to hide anything politically. I think they just led the viewer to the correct conclusion based on what you saw play out.
That's the facts, and if you don't want to believe it, fine. When we'll go back to the sports analogy. When somebody double dribbles, that's the facts.
Yeah.
Ref, he saw it. That's what happened.
Yeah, it's a fact that Cameron can't play defense. It's
a
fact.
That is a fact. It is a fact.
And never could.
I'm gonna leave that one alone. I'm gonna say because Cameron's gonna whoop my ass in a 1-on-1.
I guarantee, Chris. You said you're sort of in shape right now. I'm not. I promise you, you'd beat me at this point.
He's working on it.
No, wait a minute. He did say he's 5'9", though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
5'9"? I might be able to take him. I might be able to take him at 5'9".
You're a bit bigger than me, dude. Yeah.
All right, before we let you go, if you could just impart, what you did was you disrupted a terrorist attack. It was a terrorist attack, and you disrupted it. Our podcast is the Disruption Zone. It's about being a disruptor in a positive way. What's the best lesson on assessing a situation and disrupting it for a positive outcome?
Make a decision. And I teach people this as well when I do tactical classes or when I do my speaking, especially when I do speaking about leadership. If you're in charge, make a decision. The worst thing that you can do is make no decision. Even if you make a decision and it may be wrong, it's all right. Go 110% with that decision, and granted, you'll find your way out of it. You're gonna find success out of it. The worst thing you can do is just sit on your hands and do nothing, and that's what we did. We had a leader that could not make a decision, at least in our case, for the CIA goes, did not want, went into what we call the black. There's this thing called the OODA loop. You can search it if you want. OODA, the OODA loop.
Where observe, you have color code.
Observe, orient.
Oh, you're going to show off now, huh? You're going to show off?
Go ahead, Leland. We'll Google Google that. I don't know. It's the Google button. But you go in the black and you make no decision. That's not where you want to be. It doesn't make a difference how difficult the decision is going to be to make. You make the decision. One of the hardest decisions we made that night was we left the State Department facility without finding the ambassador. Now, you know, we leave no fallen comrade to fall in the hands of the enemy. You don't do that.
Mm.
Well, we didn't know it at the time, but when we got back and later in the night, we found out that the ambassador was still there and we couldn't find him.
Mm.
We left it. We left a man behind. Unbeknownst to us, people said, well, it's not your fault. Doesn't matter. But we made a decision because we had to get back to the annex because it was going to get attacked, and we would have lost 27 more people. It still sticks with me forever that we left a fallen comrade and we left somebody dead. We left somebody there, and I have to live with that. But we had to make the right decision. That I still would go by that decision.
You know what, Chris? You sound incredibly in that moment like our Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, who I know was a Marine, and I understand. But I mean,
he's awesome. I follow that guy. I follow that damn Semper Fi guy. He's the man.
I've fallen in love with him the past couple of years just hearing him speak. And one thing that sticks out to me, he says the most is never be inactive. You know, you can make the wrong decision. And, he's talking about as a Marine. You can make the wrong decision. You can make the right decision, but don't ever make no decision.
Yeah.
Make a decision one way or the other. Do something.
And that's what failed us and failed as far as the military personnel as well, is that when the State Department and the administration basically said, hey, they kept passing the buck. And then finally, the State Department said, no, we're not going to send any troops. You guys are basically on your own, which is what they did. Still, though, they waited and waited and waited trying to assess the situation until they finally said, you know, what's the political ramifications of it? Okay, well, we're not going to send anybody because it's going to hurt us politically. But still, that decision of that delay of 5, 6, 7 hours, that's no decision being made. And then somebody should have stepped in and sacrificed themselves and got us, at least when I'm saying leadership, sacrifice their position.
Right.
So, you know what? This is not the right thing to do. We did. We lost our jobs. We lost our security clearances. I lost all of my security clearances. I got fired by doing the right thing. I lost my State Department. Yep.
Basically because CIA
State Department did it.
Yeah, because you disobeyed orders. Is that the reason?
That's right. I disobeyed orders, and it says so in my in the write-up, at least as far as I know, because I never got to read it. but my my write-up of being insubordinate by the CIA that caused me to lose my security clearances. So which is why I can't deploy anymore. Or I would be.
But you'd probably do it all over again?
I would definitely do it all over again. Like I said, if they said, hey, here's your contract, you're going back over, like, okay, when do I leave? And I'd be back over there.
But you'd make the same decisions. The same decision you made in the past, you'd make the same decision, disobey orders if you had to.
If I'd known what I know now, I would have left. We would have disobeyed orders earlier because Ambassador Chris Stevens and Sean Smith would still be alive. Yeah. That still haunts me as well, that we kind of sat on our we followed our chain of command like we're supposed to until the chain of command's orders were no longer to us lawful orders. Right. Now we're leaving.
Man, I could talk to you all day. Yeah. I know Cameron feels the same way. I know you got to get to your kids. Real quick, you got a book out. What's the name of the book?
Ranger Way, 13 Hours is out. Of course, is written by us and me and the other team members that were still surviving. And then I have the Ranger Way I wrote. And that book's a more of a leadership book, but it goes about things I did in Iraq and Afghanistan and also as a Ranger, going through Ranger school and being at the 75th Ranger Regiment. So it's a book about failure. It really is that what it is, failure and picking yourself up.
Awesome. And then if people want to follow you, come to your events, you got a website?
Yeah, actually, ChrisTanoPorano.com, and it's with a K, guys. Yes, I spelled my name like a girl. Believe me, it was a help me grow up quick in school.
Boy named Sue. Yeah. Boy named
Sue. So ChrisTanoPorano.com, but then I also have an Instagram account. It's a Chris_Pirano_Tano. I don't have that blue check mark yet because I'm too lazy to go get it.
Yep.
And then I have a Facebook account, which does have the blue check mark that shows all my schedule. And then Battleline is our training company, me and Boone's training company, where we teach all over the country. And
awesome.
Battleline Tactical, and it's a Facebook account too. And then Twitter, but Twitter, I'm not very nice. I'm pretty mean.
All right,
on Twitter.
I'm going to follow Chris on Twitter right now.
Yeah, we're following you on Twitter. That's it. I love your Twitter feed, by the way, just so you know. So
I got to have an outlet somewhere because I don't say anything unless somebody says something.
If they come at you, why would they go at you anyway?
Well, the thing is, he's not inactive on Twitter. He decides and he acts.
Yeah, there we go.
People are so dang, they're just so, groupthink makes people, people Einsteins nowadays.
Yeah.
Groupthink, everybody knows everything because they watch everything on TV. And I know you don't, people.
Well, it's been an honor, sir. Thank you so much for your service. Thanks for disobeying orders and being an American hero.
Yes,
and thanks for the advice today.
Well, thank you, guys. And again, I'm no hero. Don't ever call me that. But I appreciate it. And guys, I really do. And good job on the Duke shot. I still remember. I was watching that. I still remember that. Everybody hated Duke at that time, too.
Yeah, we all did. Yeah, we all did.
Love it.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris, thanks so much.
Take care.
All right, bro.
Take care, guys. Have a great day.
You too.